You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Looks like you got a nice view there from your office in Philadelphia.
Well, thank you. Yes, we do.
And you've earned it. Which,
which
leads directly to my introduction of you. Well, first of all, you're familiar to Blogging Heads viewers because you were on a couple of years ago. We were talking about your book, The Next Economic Disaster, and you predicted that China in particular was due for a kind of comeuppance because of various issues in its economy, certainly some relating to debt. And in fact, I think it was after that that you wrote The Coming China Crisis for the journal Democracy. But in any event, then after that, there was the China stock market crash. So you were vindicated. What you said on Blogging Heads was vindicated. Congratulations apocalypse in China.
It's not comforting to have predicted something bad and have it come true. But yeah, China's in for a rough time for years to come.
And that will come up in our conversation today. So today we're going to talk about a few things, but certainly among them, your latest piece in the journal Democracy called The Private Debt Crisis. The billing of it reads as follows: China is drowning in debt. The whole world has too much of it. History suggests this won't end well. But you have some ideas at the end about how to avert the most apocalyptic outcome. We'll also probably talk a little about the election and so on. Because these issues do relate to the election. And in fact, we could start with what I heard on CNN only hours ago, which was some Republican saying that the reason Hillary Clinton must be defeated was that growth had been anemic. I think he said it was like 1% for several years in a row. I don't know if that's true as it pertains to the United States, but you do start this piece noting that growth has been less than spectacular globally. And the IMF has repeatedly been much too rosy in its forecast. The IMF is slow to get the picture. You've got this graph showing how year after year, the IMF says, here comes the rebound, and it never comes.
That's right. That's right. The IMF has expected what it uses kind of a normal rebound, which whatever normal means, that they've expected kind of a rosy scenario, and it has not come true. And there's two reasons it hadn't come true. One is that China in particular has amassed an enormous load of private debt, unprecedented in world history. They've added on $18 trillion in private or non-governmental debt just since 2008. And that is leading to a rapid deceleration in their growth. You know, it's gone from 15 to 6 or 7, some people say 4. We think it's going to be low single digits, near zero, in the next couple of years, and it's going to stay in that low range for quite some time, perhaps a generation, as it has in Japan. So that's one big factor. But the rest of the world loaded up with private debt, you know, leading up to the 2008 crisis, Europe, the United States, in particular, and they're still burdened with extremely high levels of private debt. And When an economy is loaded up with private debt, that means the individuals and businesses in it are loaded up with private debt. And if you got too much private debt, it's hard to invest, it's hard to spend, it dampens, it constrains global growth, and that's where we are.
And I should note that when you talk about debt, you know what you're talking about. In introducing you, we spoke about your book, which was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. But you've been in business for a very long time, often in finance. And in fact, and maybe you'll have a chance to return to this, you are one of two people credited with inventing the co-branded credit card. So like I have a credit card in my pocket right now that has United Airlines on it. A lot of people have credit cards that say have their alma mater on them or something, or some other form of co-branding. And you came up with this idea. And I guess built a company around it, sold the company, and then got into another thing. But in any event, you've been in the debt business in some sense, right?
Yeah, I was in banking for 30 plus years of my career, deeply in banking, studied debt from that perspective, long and hard, and that's really been the predicate for my further study of that, and we have built, subsequent to my career in banking, we have built a private debt database that now encompasses 47 countries and 91% of world GDP. So we really have a base from which to examine all this activity and any theories around it.
Mm-hmm. And this is part of your contention that economists still do not fully appreciate, by and large, the significance of kind of aggregate debt burden. There's a lot of specific ideological emphasis on government debt, but I think your point is that that's only part of the picture and a relatively small part.
It's the lesser part. You know, unfortunately, it's not small, but it is. Private debt is significantly larger globally than public debt. It has a more direct impact on economic outcomes, good and bad. Private debt, rapid growth in private debt, has been responsible for the financial crises we've seen over the last half century or more. Accumulated levels of private debt that are too high, as we just discussed, will dampen economic growth.
Mm-hmm. And the index you use is ratio of debt. Sometimes you're looking at overall debt, sometimes private debt, but it's debt to GDP. And a point you make in this journal article is, the way to think of that is debt to income. Like if you're a household you've got a certain amount of debt, you should compare that to your ongoing income to figure out whether it's too much debt. And in effect, I mean, GDP is national income. So
That's
the ratio of debt to all income, to individuals, to corporations, and so on. And it's the highest ever globally. Is that right?
That's right, by far.
The ratio of that. And if you have some good graphics in your piece, and one of them, and I think this may also be in your book, but it just shows this number, ratio of debt to GDP over time. And what you see is that there are periodic corrections. So it will rise and rise and rise and then drop. And alarmingly, the drops tend to come after some sort of epic dislocation or disaster. So like the Great Depression, debt to GDP rose and rose and rose, depression comes, and then a lot of the debt gets baked out of the system, I guess. But, you know, it's alarming when you look at the graph, because now the numbers are even higher than they were before the Great Depression, and you wonder, you know, historically, these things have not ended gracefully and painlessly.
Yeah, the Great Depression is certainly a case in point. Private debt, because government debt was fairly nominal in the 1920s. It was all about private debt. You know, one historian cites that there were 1,000 commercial office buildings under construction in 1927. We just built way too much, way more than we needed, and used private debt to do that. So private debt built up very rapidly in the 20s, and then came the day of reckoning, you know, 1929, 1930, and everybody took the opposite view. You know, the Secretary of the Treasury talked about liquidating all debt. So debt really collapsed nominally by about 22% and brought the pain that we experienced in the 30s. That was the issue. And so we kind of used that as a platform to try to reconstruct debt going back to the 1700s, private debt in particular, but both, for the six biggest countries in the world that collectively constitute over half of world GDP, you know, China, France, Japan, U.S., etc. And we find again and again what you just said. One of the most surprising things is a couple of researchers were looking at notary information right before the French Revolution. And you see the exact same pattern. You see a rapid rise in private debt in Paris, leading people to be way overburdened with debt. And then in the chaos that ensued, debt collapses, in that case, largely because of inflation. But it's a pattern you see over and over again over this 200-plus year period.
Is there a pattern in what kinds of people get hurt when the correction comes? We'll talk later about what your ideas are about how who should bear the burden, but is it always the little guy who winds up paying the price?
Yeah, it's inevitably the little guy, because if you just think about it, if private debt is, if there's runaway private debt and way too much gets built, whether it's railroads, as was the case in the 1800s, or commercial real estate, as was in the Great Depression, or residential real estate, as was in 08, you know, some big category like that, well, the economy has to slow down to let demand catch up with supply. And if the economic growth slumps, everybody is impacted. So folks that had contributed nothing to the problem get hurt. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happens, not always, but most of the time, is the banks that were the lenders have put out so much bad debt that it exceeds their capital. So they become in need of rescue or propping up, but in that period, really can't support economic growth through lending. So, you know, a business owner who had a nice little line of credit to stock their retail store, you know, all of a sudden might have that pulled or haircut, not because of anything they did, but because the bank has gotten wounded because of its own profligacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you referred to demand needing to catch up with supply, again, that's a reference to the concrete manifestation of too much debt being too much capacity, too often too much just physical capacity. Factories that don't have any goods to produce, apartment buildings in China that don't have anybody who wants to live in them, whatever.
That's right. Yeah, it's a really simple idea. You know, we've kind of overcomplicated this idea of a financial crisis. We build way too much of something or several somethings. We have more than we need. And economic activity, new building of homes or new building of office supplies or new building of railroads has to slow down to let organic demand catch up to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I gather it's your view that this issue has not entered the presidential debate in a serious way, as so many serious issues have failed to. But this is just not even... debt in the aggregate is not talked about, right? There are references to public debt, which you think is a non-trivial issue, but is far from the whole issue.
It's the lesser issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there, you know, there's a lot of discussion about stagnant incomes, and that's an appropriate discussion. But what has happened in the U.S. is one very important example is private debt to GDP has gone from 50% right after World War II to 150% today. That means on average, homes and businesses have three times as much debt as they did a couple of generations ago. And if you got too much debt, you know, if you're a middle-class family with a $400,000 mortgage on a $300,000 home, as has very often happened in this period, you aren't taking as many vacations as you used to. You aren't buying new cars. You aren't doing a lot of things because you're struggling just to carry what you have.
Okay. And I guess the concise version of your proposed solution, correct me if I'm wrong, is that often the lenders get bailed out and the people who borrowed the money do not. And you think there needs to be more emphasis on the people who borrowed the money, the people who are in debt?
Yeah, I mean, if you know, at the end of the, in 08, 09, you know, 25% of the mortgages in the United States, roughly, were underwater. You know, those were borrowers that needed some kind of systemic relief. If they had received it, our recovery would have been more vibrant. Our economic growth rate today would be higher. They were ignored. We propped up the financial institutions. I tend to support the idea that we have to prop up our financial institutions. I would have done it differently. I would have done it the old-fashioned way, which is you keep the institution alive, you replace the management and the board, you let the government own it interim before they remarket the stock back out to the private sector. That's kind of the way it was done during in my entire career. It was done a little bit differently this
was it was time it around. Really historically when what banks would get into trouble one by one, the government would just take them over.
It came in on Friday, shut it down. Wiped out the shareholders, owned the bank, got rid of the board, got rid of the CEO, opened on Monday morning with a CEO they had put in place. It was owned nominally by the government for some period of time until they could sell it to another bank or sell it in the open market as stock.
And in that scenario, the consumers did not pay the price. The I mean, I guess that was not always a case where there was, you know, debtors who couldn't repay their debts, right? There's various ways you can mismanage a bank, I guess.
No, no, it typically is. You know, in my career in the 1980s in Texas, it was invariably oil loans, oil-related loans. So you still have the issue of restructuring the debt with the borrower. Mm-hmm. And you remember we had the RTC to do that after the S&L crisis. Mm-hmm. But what you haven't done is disrupted the employees and the good customers and the employees of that bank, the tellers, the customer service reps. You keep everybody going, the counterparties to that bank. So it's, in my opinion, a much cleaner, healthier way to do it.
So then were the solutions a little more debtor-friendly, friendly to the people who actually owed the money then than they have been since the big crisis of 08?
It was about the same, and here's why. You know, none of these solutions have contemplated restructuring debt with the borrower. Uh-huh. They have contemplated propping up the bank. The issue is that if one little bank fails because somebody went crazy, you know, at some bank and made real estate loans that were bad, but that's an isolated incident. It's not difficult at all for the federal government, at the FDIC or whomever, to go pay out, you know, and prop that bank up. In this case, however, in 08 in the United States, the amount of bad loans that were made, by our estimate, was $2.5 trillion or thereabouts. Well, the entire U.S. banking system at that point in time only had $1.5 trillion in capital. So you couldn't do anything because the numbers were just too big. You couldn't go in en masse absent some special innovative legislative method.
Okay. So you would like to see in the future, and I guess from your point of view, better sooner than later, some sort of restructuring that does alleviate the burden on debtors who face trouble. You talk a little about this at the end of your journal article in Democracy.
Yeah, the issue is if debt is too high, or what we call leverage is too high, and we're not going to have growth unless debt is reduced, then you have to ask yourself, how do we get from here to there? And we've done a very comprehensive, frankly exhaustive study of this subject. And we looked at every single instances in our database where there's data of where countries have delevered either on the private side or the public side by 10 percentage points or more in a five-year period. There have been 92 such instances. You know, people famously talk about the debt levels after World War II and, you know, hey, we're just fine. We had high government debt after World War II, but we grew our way out of it. What we show in that particular situation is we didn't just grow our way out of it. Private debt increased by an amount greater than public debt declined. So aggregate debt in the U.S. stayed at this high level, and we just switched from public to private. And, you know, that's a steep price to pay for government deleveraging.
Right, and from your point of view, there's almost no practical difference. I mean, your view is the key index is just total aggregate debt relative to income.
You need to pay attention to that metric. Right. And so when we've looked, almost every time you have improvement in public debt leverage or public debt ratio, it's been because private debt has gone up. And the converse is true as well. Every time you've had an improvement in the private debt ratio, as in Japan after 97, it's because there was runaway growth in public debt to offset it. You know, if you didn't have that offset, you'd have economic depression. You'd have a contraction in GDP because debt almost invariably grows. Aggregate debt almost invariably grows as much or more than GDP. Mm-hmm. We've got the data. It's there. The only exceptions to that are when there's hyperinflation or if there's a massive net export position, which are, you know, a very small subset of cases. You know, we outlined this in detail in the article. So if those are the only ways that we can delever, we need another tool in our little toolkit. And to us, by process of elimination, that's debt restructuring. So for example, you know, in the case of underwater mortgages, we would propose something like allow banks to tear up contracts with borrowers and rewrite them. So if they have a $400,000 mortgage on a $300,000 house, maybe instead the bank gives them a $250,000 mortgage on that $300,000 house. So ordinarily the bank would take a $150,000 loss for doing that. So as a practical matter, they can't or don't want to. We create a special regulatory dispensation. This has been done a couple of times, by the way. And let them write that off over that 150 off over 30 years instead of 1 year. So it becomes kind of a minor, almost trivial issue to the bank. Now, the borrower can't just get this for nothing. The borrower has to give the lender a certificate that gives that lender some healthy percentage, half, three quarters of the upside when that borrower eventually sells the home. So it's kind of a debt for equity swap. And you do this systemically across the system with Fannie, Freddie, and the banks, you would have millions of consumers who have a radically improved situation and can more vibrantly participate in the U.S. economy.
Okay. And is it the case that so much of the debt problem actually remains in the mortgage market, that this would be if you really started addressing the problem now, this would be the centerpiece of the initiative? You would look at mortgages, or are there whole different kinds of problems out there?
Well, it's the biggest problem.
It is.
You know, it's you know, there's $26 trillion in private debt in the United States. About $14 trillion of that is household debt. Hmm. Of that $14 trillion, $10 trillion is mortgages. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking households, mortgages is where you go. There's brewing problems in student debt, but that's only about $1.2 trillion. Mm-hmm. So it's not big enough to be systemic. It'd be nice to create some relief there. It would help things. But $1 trillion in student debt versus $10 trillion in mortgage debt, you're going to get more oomph for your program by going after mortgage debt.
Okay.
You know, there's a little bit of problem in commercial real estate. You know, we haven't examined that as deeply perhaps as we should. Perhaps there's a program there that's similar to the one I just described, but it's real estate. You know, I guess the other big problem area right now is oil and gas, so, which is a couple of trillion. Those are the hot spots today.
You mean money having been loaned to people back when they thought the price of oil was going to be higher? Money loaned to people who are in that business?
Yeah. Back when the price was higher.
Yeah. Okay. So, the one thing you mentioned that it occurred to me in the context of the campaign is college loans. So, I assume Hillary's proposing more in the way of college loan relief than Trump, but I don't really know. I mean, it wouldn't be a huge deal, but I guess it would be something, right?
It would certainly be something, you know, over an all to an age group that is not really participating in the economy the way we had expected or they should. Mm-hmm. They come out and two facts face them. There aren't as many meaningful jobs as there have been historically. So the amount that they earn is below what prior generations have earned. And they're carrying a higher level of student debt. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good equation.
You know, I'm curious about your view of Donald Trump. He's a businessman. You're a businessman. He's kind of a fan of debt, apparently, if you look at his biography as a businessman, right? What do you have an appraisal of his? I'm sure you've kept up on the reporting on his business history.
Yeah, I mean, you know, debt is the tool that creates much of what we experiences economic growth. Mm-hmm. And the place that had the most legislative tax advantages, both to businesses and to individuals, is real estate. That's the place, that's the area that our political system has given the most goodies to.
In ways that encourage you to incur debt?
Yep. You know, you get a tax deduction if you're an individual. You get the, you know, the write-off for, you know, a depreciation on a, you know, has been widely reported over the last 3 or 4 days, you know, in Trump's situation, you can have a successful building, but since you get to depreciate that asset, it can shelter income in other businesses that he has, not just his real estate business. It's the legislature has specifically move to give advantages to the real estate industry. So, you know, it's out there. People use a lot of debt. It's probably more advantage to that industry than should be given, but it's kind of what it is.
Yeah, and apparently one distinctive thing about the way the real estate business is handled is that you can actually take losses you incur in real estate and apply them to income in non-real estate areas, right?
Yep.
Which doesn't seem quite right. Can you explain it? So this business, where he loses $900 million in 1 year, and then he can carry it forward for years and years and years. So he can deduct that against, you know, $100,000 of income this year and $80,000 next year and so on, and keep doing that. You know, intuitively, that could make a kind of sense, because in the aggregate, if he really lost the money, if he really lost $1 billion this year, made $1 billion over the next 20 years, the net is zero. He had no income. If that really happened, that you really lost the money. But did he really lose the money? I mean, does that question make sense?
Well, yeah. We don't have his tax return, so we don't know.
Right.
So any number of tax experts have speculated. But let's just say you had a healthy building, that the value of that building was increasing, it was becoming more valuable, and you could sell it at a higher price. The rents that you were being paid were increasing through time. You nevertheless can depreciate much of the value of that building and take that, you know, deduct that against the income of that building, and if there's enough of it, against other businesses as well. It's a nice structure if you're in that business.
Mm-hmm. So it's really not the case that you're really losing the money.
That's right.
Well, go ahead.
It's to incent real estate development.
Yeah. He actually, in the last debate, he mentioned depreciation as one of his, just in passing, that he's a big fan of depreciation.
Right.
What about his overall philosophy about the extent of reliance on debt? I mean, how does it compare with yours? I know you weren't in the real estate business, but you started businesses, and there's two ways to finance businesses, right? You can get investors, you can invest your own money, but there can be equity, there can be debt.
Well, this is a very important subject because, and this is really not discussed, and you don't really see this in the economic literature, but if you look at all countries where we have this data, aggregate debt, private plus public, really is necessary to cause economic growth. It almost always exceeds GDP growth. So if you have $1 trillion in GDP growth over a given period, you're going to have more than $1 trillion worth of growth in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And debt powers it through loans to build a new factory, loans to build a new building. You know, I comment in the article about the solar panel industry, which was kind of going nowhere until the industry invented a way to create a 20-year loan or 20-year lease, as it's called, to finance those. You've got to have debt to grow. So I would expect that debt grows at a pace similar or slightly ahead of GDP growth. The problem comes, and you can see it clearly in the data, when private debt growth really grows much faster than GDP growth. That is evidence that too much of something it is being built. And normally, and I was in this industry, so I know this fact well, the reason loan growth can accelerate is when bankers or other lenders find loopholes in the capital requirements of their financial institutions. So, I mean, this is an extremely important concept. If I have $1 billion in loans, I have to have $100 million in capital to support that. And if I want to put on another $1 billion in loans, I have to go out and raise another $100 million in capital. I've raised a bunch of capital. It's hard to do. So unless I find a loophole, and the banking industry is extremely creative about finding loopholes. Securitizations are a loophole. If I securitize these loans and take them off balance sheet, That means I can make the next $1 billion in loans without having to raise now, that 100 million.
Securitization sounds as if it would mean you actually have a solid foundation for the loans, right? But it means you are in some sense linking them to some assets out there or not?
Here's what it is. It's really quite simple. I take the loans that were on my balance sheet, $1 billion in loans, and I sell them to a trust, which is a shell. It's a trust that's created for this purpose. I sell the loans to the trust. The trust issues bonds secured by those loans and sells $1 billion of what is called a securitization to pension plans, insurance companies, banks, individuals. So I've sold all those loans, but it is structured in such a way that I get as much income from those loans as I would have gotten if I'd kept them on my books.
Okay.
So all I have to do is pay a cost of funds to the bondholder, which is what I would have had to pay to a depositor if they'd have stayed on the books.
So you've gotten someone else to be on the hook instead of you.
Yes. And so I don't have to carry capital against those loans. Now, that was that was true.
And they don't have to. So you've moved from a case where the person who has the debt has a legal requirement to have some capitalization to a situation where the person ultimately holding the debt has no such requirement.
That's right. Until the regulators and the accounting industry catches up with it, looks through the legality to the substance of the transaction, and begins to require you to keep some level of capital even if you securitized it. That's kind of the cycle of these things. Another way I could get rid of a capital requirement is through credit default swaps. So I have a loan on my books. I write a credit default swap against it, which is a form of insurance. If I have a credit default swap against this loan, I don't have to put up as much capital against that loan. Now, it may turn out, as it did in 08, that the counterparty, or in essence the entity that wrote the insurance against that loan, vaporizes and my insurance becomes worthless, in which case I should have been carrying capital against that because my counterparty wasn't strong enough. But of course, that's not what happened in 08. You wrote a credit default swap against the loan. You carried less capital against the loan. So all of a sudden, if the industry figures out a variety of ways to skirt or get around these capital requirements, I can be making $5 billion of loans on my layer of $100 billion in capital instead of $1 billion. When the industry figures those kinds of things out, that's when loan growth accelerates and we run into these problems.
So is the pattern that, like, there are these loopholes that permit these abuses and that permit people to get over-leveraged, and then calamity ensues, and so they close some of the loopholes, and lobbyists immediately begin agitating for new loopholes, and they get the loopholes.
Or attorneys figure out new loopholes without having to go to the
So,
and by the way, if you're inside a bank, which I spent most of my career inside of a bank, it doesn't feel like you're doing anything wrong.
No, it never feels like we're doing things wrong when we're doing things wrong, Richard. Yeah, that's the way the human mind is designed.
Because we did it. You know, we were trying to be as efficient with our capital as we could. So finding ways to be more capital efficient was beneficial to the shareholders.
Well, it's like Trump says, I took advantage of the loopholes. Everyone takes advantage of the loopholes. He's largely right. I'm sure it felt great. I wish I'd been there when you were doing these things. So let's talk a little about China, because China's come up. Trump has complained about the deal we have with, you know, our trade relations with China and their alleged currency manipulation. And I suppose this is what led the editors of Democracy to ask you to do a shorter piece, which I guess is maybe online only, I don't know, but for Democracy, called Yes, We Can Beat China. Now, first of all, I don't think that phrase occurs in the piece itself. I don't think you want to make this sound like a purely zero-sum thing between us and China, right? Because China's calamity could be bad for us.
Yeah, you know. By the way, I love the guys at Democracy, but I don't get to choose the title. So
okay, I was wondering. Yeah, I know that feeling.
So, no, China had a massive trade surplus in the period from kind of 2002-2003 to kind of 2008, maybe 2009. They had one of the largest trade surpluses in the history. I think they had the largest trade surplus in the history of the world. It was not because they manipulated their currency. It was way too big for that. It was because the Western world, Europe and the United States, had runaway debt situation, private loan situation, and were buying goods from China using that debt. So the exact period, 01 to 08, in which the West was ramping up its private debt at runaway levels, is exactly the period that China had the massive trade surplus. They were two sides of the same coin. They would have never had their trade surplus if we hadn't had our runaway debt situation. So now they can do whatever they want to today with their currency. And it's not going to make that much difference in the trade surplus or deficit. It'll make a little difference, not a lot, because the world has low level of demand right now. They can do everything they want, and it's not going to engender much in the way of trade exports to Europe and the United States, because Europe and the United States are wounded, right, and their economic growth is very slow.
And in fact, two questions. I mean, one is, you know, people talk about China manipulating its currency, but I was under the impression that it's often the case in American history where we would say, well, we have a strong dollar policy or we have a weak dollar policy, which means we're doing what we can to keep the dollar strong or sometimes to weaken it. But what's the difference between that and currency manipulation? I mean,
That's right. It's the same thing. And China was behaving in a way we would have probably behaved.
The way nations behave. I mean, but you know, it's amazing.
But right now, China's currency is stronger than it was a few years ago. And so, you know, if anything, the opposite is what has been occurring if you step back and look at it.
So currency manipulation is not the issue. I mean, leaving aside the question of whether that's the right term for it, that's not the issue.
It changes in exchange ratios between us and China are not the driving issue.
Okay, so what you didn't write the headline, yes, we can beat China, but it refers to something in your argument. What does it refer to?
You know, we have, I think, a core issue in this election, a core issue that Trump was sensitive to and Bernie Sanders was sensitive to, is guys all over the United States working for factories are losing jobs because of trade deals that don't really protect the worker as much as I, for one, believe they should. And so if you're in a small town and the biggest employer in town was a factory and you've lost that job to Mexico or China or whomever, you really don't have anywhere to go. And you have a level of concern that's easy to understand in the context of an election like this one. And so the mantra has been for many, many decades that free trade is almost, as an article of faith, a good thing. And that's simply not true.
It's not a good thing for any one nation at any one time with any one commodity.
It's like anything else. It can be good. Mm-hmm. It can be bad. It can be somewhere in between. The United States, from the 1860s to the 1910s, was probably the most protectionist nation in economic history, certainly one of them. On average, we had 40 to 50% tariffs on imports in the United States during that entire time. And we grew from being kind of at parity with Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, to being larger than the Germany, France, and the United Kingdom added together. So it cannot be true, on the face of it, that trade is a bad thing. And we began changing our trade policy when our companies became so big and so dominant that it was to our benefit to go. And what we did, we didn't go to the whole world and said, okay, it's free trade now. We went in a bilateral fashion, mainly to countries in Central and South America, and cut bilateral deals that were more or less free trade, but they were, you know, we bought their fruit and their natural resources, and we exported our manufactured goods to them, and we came out quite well in that equation. And we moved more and more towards a philosophy of free trade because our manufacturers were so strong that if we did that, it almost always worked to our advantage. It hadn't been quite as true for the last couple of decades. And, you know, we kind of forgot the history of this. And by the way, you know, as iconic a free market person as Ronald Reagan in 1987 slapped a 100% tariff on Japan just to get them to conform.
Just to get their attention. And they responded by establishing, what, quotas on their own auto exports or something?
There were three or four industries involved, uh-huh. Whatever. We quickly came to a better deal, right, as a result.
And I think even an economist would say, well, if you can use tariffs that way as a threat and a bargaining tool that leads to something or other, then that's not the big objection. The fear is that the tariffs remain in place forever and that the other country retaliates and there's
Of course you've got to manage this skillfully.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest omission is how rapidly we've allowed our workforce to be impacted and how little we've reinvested in re-equipping these workers with new skill sets. And it's, you know, we could have done more. I think, you know, multinational corporations who have the predominant influence in Washington really are more interested in selling their goods and services in other countries than they are perhaps in making sure we have a gentle transition for people in the United States.
Right. It's funny because, you know, when I think one case of a country that used kind of managed trade rather than pure free trade to its advantage was Japan when it was thriving, like in the 70s and 80s. And back then, I remember in the late 80s, when you'd say to Americans, well, why did we do the same thing? They would say, well, look, the fact is, yeah, in theory, managed trade, if done really skillfully, you decide which industries you need to protect for a few years while they grow. You decide which X, Y, and Z. If you do it as brilliantly as the Japanese, it could work. But with our political system, special interests would ruin it. There wouldn't be a coherent strategy. But I think I take out of what you just said and what you mentioned in this piece is that, you know, comparable corruption has entered the free trade, so-called free trade agreements we do, which is that the powerful de facto lobby force are like American shareholders in corporations. And maybe, you know, corporate executives and so on, and they have their way, but increasingly their benefits, their welfare is not correlated with the welfare of actual American workers.
Well, you bring up Japan. I think it's worth noting. There was a brilliant book that came out not too long ago called Altered States by a gentleman named Michael Schaller, who really took some State Department papers that had been released, you know, after the fact, and went and re-examined Japan's economic history after World War II. Mm-hmm. And it's really illustrative, but one of the issues was we needed Japan to help in the logistical prosecution of the Vietnam War. In particular, we needed Okinawa, which was a Japanese property, for launching our bombers to bomb Vietnam. Well, the population in Japan was violently opposed to that. There, I think the number is something like 5 million protesters hit the streets over a period of 3 or 4 or 5 years in Japan in the late 60s, protesting their assistance of the United States bombing missions. And the Liberal Democrat, the ruling party there, kind of went to the State Department and said, guys, give us something here. You know? And the something we gave them were a little bit here and a little bit there in terms of trade benefits for the textile and automobile industries.
And the rest is history.
And it's easy for me to sit here and imagine that there have been innumerable small or large trades for political sport in exchange for economic advantage, again and again to the disadvantage of American workers. So you have a couple of places where you're getting, at the margin, the benefits to the American worker are getting chipped away at a little bit. And I think our position is we ought to just change our priorities there a little bit.
As it happens, those bombing runs weren't probably such a great idea anyway.
Yeah, well, the war itself wasn't such a great idea.
Yeah.
And by the way, the one of the things the book, this is a tangent, but you know, one of the things Schaller points out is Japan at that point in time really had only a couple of places to go as trading partners, China or the Soviet Union or the eastern part of the Soviet Union. Those are its natural trading partners. And the United States, screw the domino theory, which was the line we all got, right? They were just saying, hey, Japan was naturally going to fall into the orbit of China or the Soviet Union because of the trade between the two. And our real mission was to create a third trading nexus for Japan, and that was Indochina. And that was why Vietnam was important. The only two, in fact, there were two other places to go. The United States, they could trade with us, and our businesses weren't fond of that idea, or Southeast Asia. And that's really the underpinnings of our desire to prop up Vietnam.
Now, the other place Japan enters your argument is that you look at China's current woes and you say they somewhat parallel the woes that Japan experienced after its much-discussed period of prosperity in the 80s, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my formative years in business, you know, Japan was going to take over the world.
Oh, yeah, I remember it. I remember how terrified everyone was. There was a cover of the Atlantic magazine. The headline was "Containing Japan." Right. They were talking about just economics. It wasn't a military war, but they were talking about containment.
Well, and in the towards the end of that period, Japan was buying Rockefeller Center, buying Pebble Beach Golf Club, and we thought they were going to take over the world. That period was very simply runaway, out of control private lending. They had the same kind of run-up in private debt that we had prior to 08, that we had prior to 1929, that Southeast Asia had prior to 1997. It's the same situation. And, of course, once you've built way too much of something, in this case it was mainly commercial real estate, things have to reverse. Just the way, you know, the banks had made way more bad loans than capital existed in the Japanese banking system. They had a lot of empty buildings. And their economy had to slow down. And it has grown since that period, since that crisis. It has grown at about 0%. Nominally, it's grown at 0% for the last 25 years. That's what China is looking at. You know, we're worried right now. China's buying trophy properties around the world. Well, that's Chinese trying to get the money out of China. You know, it's not that difficult to understand. If you had a lot of money, you kind of want to get it out of China. And they've overbuilt. They're going to slow down, and they're going to see a generation of low growth because they've overbuilt. One very instructive thing to note about China's or Japan's crisis is they had a stock market collapse in 1990, a real estate collapse in 91, and the banking rescue didn't come till 97. So it really took 7-8 years for that crisis to unfold. It was a slow motion unrolling of the crisis. I think we've got something similar to that going on in China. I think Chinese government's going to be able to prop up its banks. It's not going to be able to prop up economic growth for very long.
So to get back to that headline, yes, we can beat China. I mean, I gather one thing you would do, I mean, you wouldn't put it quite that way, maybe, in terms of beating China, but in terms of competing with China, one thing we can do is smarter trade deals that are less in the thrall of a kind of uncritical allegiance to so-called free trade above all. But at the same time, I mean, one of our big concerns is not that China will do way better than us, but in a sense that they'll do way worse than us. I mean, a true collapse would be bad, right?
Yeah, yeah. The time for us to have been jousting with China was probably when Bill Clinton, you know, had led the effort to let him into the WTO, and you know, a couple of things happens. You know, those were the years for us to have modified, softened, created a more gradual something to soften the transition of letting them in. Now we may end up with the opposite problem. Now we may be part of a group of folks that kind of needs to at least be friendly to China as they deal with really, really difficult situation. And friendly may be the wrong word, because on top of this economic crisis, they have a political crisis. They have, you know, Xi has clamped down on his political opposition. There are hundreds of thousands of people either, you know, under investigation or in jail or what have you. He's now hinting at the idea that he's going to stay in power beyond his normal term. They got a basket full of problems that are going to happen at the same time.
Well, yeah, they're in a period where prosperity generally involves robust use of modern information technologies like the internet, but those same technologies make life complicated for a one-party rule, yep. Right? I mean, and yep. That's the problem they face. And, you know, I think, I mean, there's a fair amount of nationalism in China, including some anti-American nationalism. Same in Russia. That may, to some extent, be cultivated by insecure leaders in both cases, but it's kind of a messy time. Let me ask you that question generally. You've been alive a while, like me. Do things feel more precarious than they to you right now in the world generally? All things, you know, Middle East, economics, the internal situation in the United States, do things feel more precarious to you than they typically do or than ever before, or not at all?
Yeah, I my own view as I've, you know, read history over a sustained period is that it's economic duress that leads to these kind of political situations. And you know, right now with decelerating economic growth, with, you know, an unfolding crisis in China, with, you know, significant economic reversal in Africa and South America, primarily because they had built their economies over the last 5 or 10 years on exports to China. You've got stress in a lot of places around the world. And in my view, that often leads to strongman politics.
Mm-hmm. And I assume this is the weirdest presidential election you recall?
It is.
Any elaboration on that?
It's. You know, I just had lunch with Governor Rendell here in Pennsylvania, and he was commenting on it. The rumor that's floating around these days, by the way, is that Trump has recognized that he's not going to win. But and by the way, this may have no substance to it, but it's a rumor to contemplate that he's going to launch a cable channel.
Oh yeah, I've been hearing that for some time, and it's not crazy. I mean, look, he's going to get out of this with something. First of all, I'm not ruling out that he could win. I'm too superstitious to do that. But things are good. Polls have gone up and down as we tape this. The polls are looking pretty good for Hillary, but who knows? But I certainly think he wants to come out of this with something. And you can find people speculating months and months ago about Trump TV as one possibility. He's now very close to Roger Ailes, who was exiled from Fox News. And I think in a way the question is, does he more want to come out of this with a business like that? Or with a movement behind him, or does he want something where there's a connection between the two, which there could be with Trump TV, just as there is between symbiosis between Fox News and conservatism. There could be, you know, Trump TV could represent this kind of nationalist, nativist conservatism. It wouldn't surprise me. The scary thing to me is that would then, as a competitive matter, would pull Fox in its direction.
Or bring Fox to its knees.
Maybe.
You got Ailes running Trump TV.
Yeah.
You got Trump TV hiring, you know, Hannity and
Absolutely.
But anyway, getting back to the election. You know, here's the dilemma to me, and that is if Hillary wins, as it looked like she will, I'm not sure she has the formula for economic revival. So, you know, I don't think she recognizes, most politicians don't, this private debt issue. You know, I don't think she's sufficiently focused on the trade issue. I don't think I'm not. She's got kind of the same old formula that the Democrats have, which really don't get to the heart of what we need to get the economy going. So she gets in office. Things continue to be mediocre. You've got, you know, a demagogue like Trump, you know, railing at her from the sidelines.
Yep.
It could stay ugly.
All right, yeah, I think it's going to stay ugly regardless, because you either got him as president or him say, you know, being aggrieved and saying the election was rigged and riling up his followers. I mean, as for Hillary and the economy, one thing we don't know is what assurances she gave Bernie Sanders in exchange for his support and how binding they can be. I mean, one thing he would have wanted was a revision of her trade policy, for sure. And she probably said something or other about that, but who knows. Now, on the question of government debt, which I think you also think is somewhat important, you know, Trump acts like he's more concerned about it than she is. But so far as I can tell, she's closer to having a fiscally responsible budget than he is. I mean, I don't think he's even thought about it. I think she's at least thought about the fact that there has to be some correspondence between, you know, revenue and expenditures.
Unfortunately, however, it is true that if you get fiscally responsible, I mean, the math right. is simple. GDP is
right.
private sector spending plus government spending plus net imports or exports, plus or minus net imports. If she curtails government spending, that has a dragging effect on the economy for some period of time. So, you know, that's why I advocate so strenuously this idea of debt restructuring, is that you get fiscally responsible, you've got a slump to get through while you're doing that.
Because historically, when we've gotten fiscally responsible and it hasn't hurt us, that's been because private debt was growing without anybody noticing.
Well, one of the great examples is Ronald Reagan's era. Yeah. And that was one of the highest periods of both private debt and public debt growth mm-hmm. in this century. In fact, it's third only to the Great Depression and the Great Recession in terms of how much runaway private lending we had. And by the way, as he kind of was walking out the exit, we had an S&L crisis, we had a stock market crash, we had the RTC, we had a financial crisis mm-hmm. at the end of the 80s mm-hmm. that was, you know, kind of the making of loose private lending.
So in general, when really high debt has kind of gotten corrected, we have had to pay the price, we've taken our medicine, and I gather you think that the one way to avoid taking really harsh medicine is this debt restructuring thing.
It's got to be part of the equation. If private debt is part of the problem, a big part of the problem, central to the problem, then dealing in some form or fashion with private debt has to be part of the solution.
Okay, I will take your word for that, and I will hope that the next president seeks your counsel. Thank you, Richard Vague. I think I forgot to mention that you're a managing partner at Gabriel Investments here in Philadelphia, which is a venture capital firm. Is that right?
That's right.
And chair of the Governor's Woods Foundation.
Thank you.
And formerly several things, CEO of Energy Plus, of Juniper Financial, and of First USA Bank. That's all true. And people can read this, both of these pieces. I guess both are on the web at the Journal Democracy, both the long.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. And your book, The Next Economic Disaster, continues to be worth reading because it has proven to be prescient. All right. Well, thank you, Richard. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks for your interest.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.